Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 10, Chapter 7, The Killing of the Demon Trinavartha, Text Number 3. Atanyad Api Krishnasya Toka Charitam Adbhutam Manusham Lokam Asadya Tajatim Anurundataha. Ata, also, anyat, api, other pastimes also, krishnasya, of child Krishna, toka acharitam, adbhutam, they're also wonderful childhood pastimes, manusham, as if playing as a human child. Loka asadya. Appearing on this planet in human society. Tatyatim. Exactly like a human child. Anurundataha. Who is imitating. Translation of Purport by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada. Please describe other pastimes of Krishna, the Supreme Personality, who appear on this planet Earth, imitating a human child, and performing wonderful activities like killing Putana. Purport. Maharaj Pariksit requested Shukadeva Goswami to narrate other childhood pastimes exhibited by Krishna while playing as a human child. Supreme Personality of Godhead incarnates at different times in different planets and universes. And according to the nature of those planet places, he exhibits his unlimited potency. As a child sitting on the lap of his mother was able to kill the gigantic Putana, it's extremely wonderful for the inhabitants of this planet. But on other planets, the inhabitants are more advanced. And therefore, the pastime the Lord performs there are still more wonderful. Krishna's appearance on this planet, like a human being, makes us more fortunate than the demigods on the higher planets. Therefore, Maharaj Pariksit was very much interested in hearing about him. So most wonderful doesn't mean necessarily the best. Although we like to, especially in the passionate age of Kali Yuga, the more exciting something is, then we think it's better. If we watch the old movies in India, Sita's Wedding, or Nimai Nachala. Nimai Nilachala? What's that? Nilachala. Then they're not so exciting. There's no guns. No one's being shot to pieces. Probably no one gets stabbed. There's no material romance as we have in the material world. It's rather boring for most people. Because just like food that we eat is according to the mode of material nature we're in. Therefore, we may notice that our taste is not always so steady because it depends upon which our particular mode of nature we're being influenced by. So one day we may hanker for pizza, and the next day we may look at it and think, how did I ever eat that? How is that possible? And then the next day we get attracted to something else as the modes change. So, in the same way, as we advance in Kali Yuga, as the modes change to the lower modes of material nature, so people's taste also changes. Not only for our food, which is more or less, you can tell, the quality of the civilization by what they eat. That those who are more in the mode of goodness, they eat sattvic food. And those who are in the mode of passion, they're attracted to rajasic food. And those in the mode of ignorance are attracted to tamasic food. So as we can see that, generally speaking, society, for the most part, has become more and more degraded in terms of its taste. Everything, the way they dress or undress, the way they, the chemicals they put on their body, the way they talk. If you go to America, certain parts of America, even I can't understand what they're saying. Because it's not even close to English. It's not close to anything legible. Even the animals probably communicate more intelligently. But that's due to the modes of nature. The soul is always the same, but the modes change. And therefore, now people are not excited by anything which is not exciting. They don't like relationships. Real relationships. The only relationships that they appreciate is intense lust, intense anger, and top it off, the cherry on the top is intense greed. That's the, if you're intensely greedy, you're considered to be the hero of society, the exemplary person. If you can steal everyone's money, then you're considered to be super intelligent. Although from the point of view of the Veda culture, your next destination will be lower than that of a worm. So how intelligent is that? If you steal everyone's money and try to enjoy it, how much can you actually enjoy? Like there was one so-called spiritualist, and he got his followers to buy for him something like 80 Rolls Royces. He loved Rolls Royce. But how many can you drive a day? And where are you going to go with your Rolls Royce? Buy another Rolls Royce? But then if you have 80 Rolls Royces, you have to have 80 people taking care of them. So complicated. You have to pay for the insurance. You have to clean it. You have to maintain it. You have to pay for it. So complicated. And you can't even use it. And yet they think they're advancing. So Kali Yuga, as we'll see in the next verse, means to make everything simply more and more complicated and miss the point of life. But the point of life can only be understood properly in the mode of goodness. But because they're advancing in passion and ignorance in every way, being misled by false propaganda, that accumulation of material goods means advancement, where it actually doesn't make advancement at all. It makes advancement in, as Krishna says, Trividam Narakasyedam Dwaram Nashitam Atmanaha Kama Krodha Tatalovas Tasmat Etam Trayam Trajet. There are three gates leading to hell, namely lust, anger, and greed, and every sane man should become free from these three gates because they lead to the degradation of the self. So if we want to become degraded like everyone else is in Kali Yuga, we just have to follow what they're doing. Hear about what they're doing, develop some desire to do what they're doing, and then we become just like they are, running after phantasmagoria, running after illusion, the mirage in the desert, that finally I'm going to get everything I want. If I can just get money, or as Prahlad Maharaj said, money, money, sweeter than honey. That the professional soldier, the thief, and the merchant, they'll risk their very dear lives to get money. Why? Because with money you can buy honey. But how much honey do you need? So therefore, we find out that the residents of this earth planet are actually more fortunate than the residents of the heavenly planets, because here Krishna doesn't exhibit such wonderful activities. Few times, I mean, he kills the demons, but no one takes it seriously. We don't take it seriously either. But certainly residents of Vrindavan don't take it seriously either. Although, if we accept theoretically that they're actually present when some witch comes to kill Krishna, and Krishna sucks out her life air along with her milk and her poison and kills her, and she winds up 27 kilometers long, and by the influence of yoga maya, the residents don't think it's a big thing. They think Krishna, somehow or another, it happened by some pious activities of Mother Jasoda and Nanda Maharaj in the past lifetime, and maybe our pious activities. So Krishna is a good person, this demon was bad, so naturally, material nature killed the bad person and keeps the good person. But they never thought Krishna did it. Because they're in love with Krishna, they can't really, and love, you can't love someone deeply if you know that they're in every atom. It's a little bit, if you know they know past, present, future, it's hard to play games with them. If you ask them, which hand is it in? They automatically know. So therefore Krishna doesn't act so wonderfully in Goloka Vrindavan or in Gokula Vrindavan. He acts like an ordinary cowherd boy. Otherwise, how could he fight with his friends? How could he gamble with the gopis? In Vaikuntha, Narayan is, everyone respects Narayan as Supreme Person, but the intimacy is not so great as it is in Goloka Vrindavan. Although the activities there may be even more wonderful, there are airplanes there. You don't generally find airplanes in Goloka Vrindavan. There are so many things going on in the heavenly planets. They have mountains of gold. They have they have rivers of sugarcane juice and jambu juice and mango juice. You can go and bathe the demigods for vacation. They don't go to the ordinary salt ocean to bathe. They go to the milk ocean to bathe. Or they can go to the ocean of yogurt, if you like, if it's the season. The ocean, there's also an ocean of sugarcane juice. So if you have a sweet tooth, you want to go on vacation, where would it be better than to bathe, to go for swimming in the ocean of sugarcane juice? Just open your mouth and you get your sugar quota for the day. But in Goloka Vrindavan, it's not like that. They have flowers and fruits and they dance and make garlands for Krishna. But nothing extraordinary as in the other places, in the higher planetary systems. But the thing that's prominent there is love for Krishna. That's all. They simply love Krishna because Krishna is unlimitedly attractive. And as he's unlimitedly attractive, he's also unlimitedly lovable there. When he displays only his sweetness is unlimited. And if there's any question of Aishwarya or irreverence, it also doesn't exist. Yogamaya has to disappear. So only loving relationships, sweet loving relationships go on there. And the devotees there only consider that Krishna is like one of them. He's a hometown boy, so to speak. Not extraordinary, but extraordinarily lovable because how sweet he is. He's so kind to the elderly people. He's so fun to be with for the cowherd boys. He's so affectionate with the gopis that everyone loves Krishna. And sometimes they think Krishna is getting into difficulty and they can't bear it. They sacrifice their own lives for Krishna. Because they love him so much. When the second fire came, the forest fire, then, although it says that the cowherd boys appealed to Krishna to save them, but also our commentators, our acharyas say that the cowherd boys surrounded Krishna because they thought, let us get burned first to save Krishna. They didn't think Krishna is God, he's going to save us. They said, let us save Krishna. We'll sacrifice ourselves for Krishna. Of course, Krishna saved them, but he gives them an opportunity also to show their unlimited affection for him. So that makes it even more appealing. If we go back to Goloka Vrindavan, we won't think that you know, here is Krishna, he's God. I hope he doesn't remember all the things, bad things I did in the material world. He has a good memory, but no, we don't even think. Krishna, he doesn't think like that. Yoga Maya puts him into illusion. So he never has to think anything like that. He just thinks that he's a coward boy and that he's dependent on Mother Jasoda. He's a good friend. He's always thinking of how to become a better friend to his friends in Goloka Vrindavan. And he's the subordinate lover to the gopis. He's overwhelmed by their affection and love so that he's completely submissive to them most of the time, not always. So therefore, we can't expect something. I mean, there are wonderful things going on here, but the residents don't notice it. But it's for us to notice how Krishna kills the demons, because we also have to remember that we want Krishna to kill our demoniac mentality so we can enter into the same type of loving relationship that Krishna has with his friends and parents and the gopis in Vrindavan. So therefore, he sends demons both so that the pastimes can go on and the residents of Vrindavan here can develop more attachment for him. At the same time, give us some lessons. Better to be a resident, to imitate or follow the residents of Vrindavan rather than to imitate the demons, because they always lose. And it's very sad to be on the losing side all the time. Gets a little frustrating after a while. Any questions about this? So we'll read the next one, which is Sugadeva Goswami said, when Mother Jasoda's baby was slanting his body to attempt to rise and turn around, this attempt was observed by a Vedic ceremony. Such a ceremony called Uttana, which is performed when a child is due to leave home for the first time, the child is properly bathed. Just after Krishna turned 3 months old, Mother Jasoda celebrated the ceremony with other women in the neighborhood. On that day, there was a conjunction of the moon with the constellation Rohini. As the brahmanas joined by chanting the Vedic hymns and professional musicians also took place, this great ceremony was observed by Mother Jasoda. Purport. There is no question of overpopulation or of children's being a burden for their parents in a Vedic society. Such a society is so well organized and people are so advanced in spiritual consciousness that childbirth is never regarded as a burden or botheration. The more a child grows, the more his parents become jubilant, and the child's attempts to turn over are a source of jubilation. Do you know anyone who became jubilant watching the child turn over for the first time? Did your parents become jubilant when they saw you turn over?
I don't remember.
They probably don't either. And the child attempt to turn over is also a source of jubilation. Even before the child is born, when the mother is pregnant, many recommended ritualistic ceremonies are performed. For example, when the child has been within the womb for 3 months and for 7 months, there is a ceremony the mother observes by eating with neighboring children. This ceremony is called Swada Bhakshana. Similarly, before the birth of the child, there is a Garbhadana ceremony. In the Vedic civilization, childhood or pregnancy is never regarded as a burden, rather as the cause of jubilation. In contrast, people in modern civilization do not like pregnancy or childbirth. And when there is a child, they sometimes kill it. We can just consider how human society has fallen since the inauguration of Kali Yuga. Although people still claim to be civilized, at the present moment there is actually no human civilization, but only assembly of two-legged animals. Not very complimentary, is it? Maybe I should read this at Rath Yatra. Because the fact is, Chaitanya Charitamrita, Srimad Bhagavatam outlines the beginning of Kali Yuga started with the beating of the cow and the bull. And after that, as I explained before, everything goes down. If the cow and the bull are neglected, then everything else will become degraded. Because anad bhavati bhutani, the main activity in human society is really getting something to eat. As we might notice, people don't necessarily, if we had festivals, but there was no prasadam, people only came for the lecture, there might only be a lecturer there, the person who's giving the lecture and the deities, because they have a taste for hearing. And everyone else, there'd be much fewer people coming. But because there's prasadam, people wait patiently, or not so patiently sometimes, for the time to eat. Because all living entities subsist on food grains. It's one of the, if we have no other, nothing else available, we have food available, and water and air, which are also food, then we can remain satisfied. But if we have no clean air, we have no clean water, we have no clean food, we don't have any food, well, no matter what else we have, we're not going to be happy or satisfied. So therefore, food is essential. But food doesn't come by accident. It comes from performing prescribed duty, of which one of the prescribed duties is protecting the cows and the bulls, so that we can avoid sinful activity, avoid industry and technology, which are the main elements of advancing a demoniac civilization, the main instruments. With industry and technology have been developed for massive armaments, weapons, for massive slaughterhouses, intoxication, illicit sex, and gambling. This is how technology has advanced civilization and all the sinful activities. And, of course, we're not decrying technology and industrialization because we utilize it in Krishna's service, or we're supposed to utilize it in Krishna's service. To, and what's our objective is to come back to a sane civilization where there's no need for technology. As we'll find out when Krishna attacks Kamsa, Kamsa doesn't take out an automatic weapon to defend himself, he takes out a sword. Now we wonder, you know, Kamsa, he went all over the universe, defeated all the demigods with a sword. Maybe a shield also. Why didn't he get a machine gun or maybe an atomic bomb, throw it at Indraloka and destroy it, and say, I won? No, people that were quite powerful, demigod, to defeat the demigods is not something ordinary, to actually have so much power to defeat a demigod. But the power didn't come from simply the weapon, it came from his consciousness, his development of the ability to fight. The power and the strength and the energy and the ability doesn't depend upon so-called modern weapons. As we can see, the weapons become more powerful, the soldiers become weaker. In fact, they don't even need the soldiers anymore. They use robots. You don't fight soldier, soldier, you fight robot, robot. And anyone else who gets in the way, the soldiers are all hiding, and the civilians are the ones who get killed by the robots. So it is not that human civilization, industrialization, and technology has really made any substantial advancement. For instance, as Prabhupada said, if you advance in weapons, then you can kill people quicker. But what's the value of that? Because people are going to die anyhow. What credit do you get? They were going to die in 2 years and you decided you're going to kill them in 50 seconds. What value is it? Are they going to take birth anyhow and fight against you again? It's just going to go on. Or as it says, the next third world war will be fought with the modern weapons, and the fourth world war will be fought with rocks and sticks, because that's what will be left. So what was the advancement? On the other hand, it mentions here that children were valued because children will grow up and become the next generation. And what are the children supposed to be doing? Are they supposed to be becoming animals, be trained up as animals, unloved, as simply are something to be exploited by the parents? Is that what that's human civilization? Or are they supposed to be loved and cared for and protected so they grow up and they can develop Krishna consciousness and become more loving and protect their children, protect society, protect the animals, protect all living entities? Come closer to reality that all living entities are spiritual beings and that they're lovable because they're all part and parcel of Krishna. Krishna is supremely lovable, and everyone is lovable. And if children are trained up from the point, if they're shown love at the beginning of their existence, then they can learn how to love others also. Otherwise, if there's no love in their lives, how can they love anyone? So therefore, that's the main thing, that the generations are supposed to train people up. Their next generation is love and affection, respect for all living entities. That's actually training. Everything else is ignorance, is misguiding people. And yet that's what modern civilization is aimed at. It's just simply making things that are not actually valuable. Tucha bhat, or the te vidu swartha gatim hi vishnu. The rashi aye bahir artimanina. Because they don't know that the aim of life is to attain Krishna, therefore they take something insignificant as very important, and they become misdirected. So the whole civilization is misdirected from real love, real affection, real appreciation, real opulence, real happiness, misdirected towards chasing after some false sense of accomplishment. If you can stand on one finger, then you're considered to be very advanced. Although, what value does it do to anyone if you learn how to stand on one finger? You'll probably break after some time anyhow. But if you can actually direct people towards higher consciousness, cleanliness, mercy, truthfulness, austerity, then that's considered a waste of time in modern civilization. Because it doesn't advance, it doesn't help people become more and more robotic, more and more the opposite of mercy, austerity, cleanliness, and truthfulness. So, in other words, real civilization is Vedic civilization, and everything else is simply a deviation from reality and will make people unhappy and disgusted and simply lead to lamentation and hankering, nothing more than that. Although by modern civilization there's so much propaganda that they're advancing, and people, that's all they hear, so therefore our business is to let them hear something else. And not only hear something else, but show an example. Otherwise, we won't believe it either unless we live it. We just talk about it all the time. So I'll stop there. Thank you. Any questions on this? Comments?
Maharaj, you gave that example with the guru who has the disciples to buy I don't know how many cars. And it occurred to me that it's not actually about how many cars one can have, but actually about the power to make your disciples do such things for you. And I was thinking that even in our society we can see that struggle for power sometimes. For people who want to have I don't know, more disciples, to have authority over a temple, over a region, over a country, and so on. And at the end you said that we have to show an example. So if we cannot show example of how not to struggle for power, how can we preach to the mundane people?
Well, Krishna says, yad richa lava shantusto, dvanvatito nimatsuraha, siddhasya kripa, yad richa lava shantusto, dvanvatito nimatsuraha, siddhasido nivikara, sattvakara. Let me get the right one. Kidricha Labashantu Stodwan Vatito Samatra Samaksida Siddhava Chakri Papina Nabhajite. One who is satisfied with gains which comes of his own accord, who's free from duality and does not envy, who's satisfied both with success and failure, is never entangled although performing action. So we're not opposed to people, devotees, having power and influence. After all, Pariksha Maharaj was very powerful. All our many leaders here, Maharaj. But the motivation should be to utilize everything in Krishna's service. We should utilize that power to serve the purpose of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu in our particular age. So if they do that, then that's all right. If things are utilized in Krishna's service to spread the Sankirtan movement. But some people, naturally, they have the karma to acquire power, influence, wealth, whatever else. It just has to be utilized properly, that's all.
And if the motivation is their own ego?
That, what can we do about it? Then they'll have to learn the hard way. You know, when you get down to the ego motivation, you're getting really subtle. Who's going to correct that? I mean, that's what the GBC, that's why Prabhupada put in authority. But if the GBC or the other authorities, we may be motivated, but Krishna will correct it also. If we can't correct it, you know, Krishna will correct it. Or in the process of performing devotional service, if we do it correctly, to the best of our ability, we may be, have other motivations that we're not even aware of. But gradually these things will be corrected by Krishna and by experiencing a higher taste. Because after all, the mercy of Krishna comes in proportion to our sincerity to try to become Krishna conscious and give it to others. So Krishna will also give some mercy. And therefore our misdirected motivations will also gradually become purified too in the course of time. Either by experience or by Krishna's mercy. So we should worry somewhat about other people, what they're doing, but not, we should worry more about what we're doing. Because if we can become purified, then Krishna will give us the intelligence to help them become purified themselves. And if we just worry about others becoming purified, we won't become purified and we won't get the intelligence how to help them either.
It's not about worrying about others being purified, it's about worrying that others have some power that affects us.
Well, that,
the way they manage their power.
Then we do the best we can to correct it. You know, sometimes that's a possibility that someone may interfere with our service, but then everything depends on Krishna anyhow. So we have to rely upon, ask him what we should do. Just like Vasudeva understood that his wife was about to be killed by Kamsa, so he did the best he could. He didn't stand there and say, go kill her, you know. Everything's arranged by Krishna, so I guess what can I do? No, he tried the best he could, and he made, you know, he utilized his intelligence to the best he could to try to convince Kamsa, but ultimately he had to surrender because we're not the controllers. Ultimately things are depending upon Krishna, so therefore he offered the children to Kamsa.
Also I want to ask about the fact that we preach all these principles, we preach to the other people, but sometimes even in our society we don't respect them. And then the people come to say, you want to preach to us, but you cannot preach to your own, because they don't respect them. What do we do in such case?
Well, we try to make advancement to help so that we can come, the society can come to the proper standard. what we have within our power. We have two things. We have a number of things. We have what's within our influence, and which is our concern. Within our influence is our own personal advancement in Krishna consciousness. And we may have concern about other things that are going on in the society. So if we can, if it's within our influence to do something, we do it. And if it's not, then we can't become overly concerned. And we should understand that if I personally advance, then my influence may increase and I may be able to help. But it's between them and Krishna. Krishna is the ultimate enjoyer. He's the ultimate proprietor. He's the ultimate friend. Everyone has a relation with Krishna. So ultimately it boils down to what everyone's personal relation with Krishna is. We can try to help them develop more, but not everyone's going to listen to us, and so therefore we shouldn't try to influence so many people who won't listen to us, because we'll be preaching to the faithless. We should find the people we can help and do a service to Krishna in that way. Try to help the persons we can help, and try to, you know, utilize our intelligence to understand how to relate to others we can help.
Yeah.
Anything else? Hola, Grantaraj, Srimad Bhagavatam, Kijaj.